Good day and welcome back to the Sydney Hems Debrief. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you again on now episode 7 of the series. My name is Dr. Samuel Bulford, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Jackie Buckthorpe, who's one of the Sydney Hems critical care paramedics. I've been badgering Jackie for some time now to come onto the podcast, so I'm absolutely delighted that we're able to record this one today. Jackie, thank you for putting up with my incessant nagging and for coming on to talk with us. How's it going?
It's going really well, Sam. To be honest, it's me that should be apologising. I agreed to do this a long time ago, and my life management, time management is poor, and unfortunately, you bore the brunt of that. So I'm also very happy to be here.
But that's such a contrast to what you're like on a job. And I'm going to share this story now. Like, one of my first jobs, Jackie, I don't know if you remember, was with you, and I was blown away because we were driving lights and sirens to what sounded like a pretty sick patient, and you were both navigating, clarifying the exact location, organizing blood products to scene, liaising with the other crews, and telling me about your child's soccer match all at the same time. And it was just the most incredible experience, and my jaw was like on the floor. It was amazing. So I don't think that time management or prioritization is necessarily a problem, but we are nevertheless here now. And maybe you could, following that little introduction from me, maybe you could tell us a bit about yourself and how you've come to be in this job.
I think that story is more insight into the chaos of my mind, and other people in my life might view that differently. But I have been lucky enough to be a critical care paramedic for just over 4 years out here at Bankstown Road Retrieval. I've been a paramedic for, January will be 20 years for me. I started in Victoria. I moved up to New South Wales after 4 years, and I've done the last 16 years up in Sydney. I have been absolutely converted to a New South Wales style paramedic. I tried desperately to hold on to my Victorian roots, but I lost them.
And you've recently become one of the Sydney Hems educators, I understand.
Yeah, in an unusual sort of way, there's an educator role for part of the pre-care trial, which is a pre-hospital ECMO trial. So not a full-time, long-time educator at retrieval, but my role, along with Chris Innes, is to contribute to education of broader ambulance as to how they can work with the pre-care team.
Pre-care is certainly something that we will probably talk about in a later episode. But I think awesome. This morning we'll instead focus on one of your cases, which I think has stuck with you. Maybe you could kick us off.
Yeah. The case I want to talk about, I think, has the potential to be clinically rather benign. And I worry that I'm not going to meet the grade, but it's something that I have thought about as a job. I did a number of years before coming out to medical retrieval. I was an intensive care paramedic. I thought at the time that I was a confident, well-organized, astute professional. And I still kind of hope that maybe I was, in spite of the story that I'm about to tell you. And to be honest, I didn't reflect on the job in the immediate months afterwards. It's been since I've come to retrieval and learnt from some of the gurus of human factors and some of the teaching that happens here, which has given me a little bit of a different insight and a different lens to look at this job with, which I've found interesting since being here. And so to kick it off and tell you about the job, it's going to be a lot of logistical stuff. I was in a role, as I said, as an intensive care paramedic. My partner was a qualified paramedic but a not intensive care. I was working as a part-time employee, which meant, you know, in hindsight, a little bit less stability. You don't have the same partner every day. Your work locations are different. So I think you don't form such good habits in your practice. But we were driving along, chatting, drinking coffee on the way to a job that didn't require an urgent response. When we were interrupted by the dispatcher, who told us there was an urgent response we were being redirected to, and we were told that it was a child having an allergic reaction. So all of this seemed fairly straightforward. As I said, I was driving, and typically in an ambulance, the person driving does more of a logistical role and the person in the treating seat does the clinical treatment role. Those roles can cross over, but that's the way it normally plays out. So as we head off towards this job, my partner found more information in our data terminal that gave the age of the child. It suggested the child had been bitten potentially by a funnel web spider, but perhaps it had an allergic reaction. And the information was a bit unclear as to were we travelling to an envenomation or were we travelling to an anaphylaxis. It was unclear. But either way, we put the lights and sirens on and we proceed. The destination's about 15 minutes away. We actually made a bit of a coherent plan as to the things we thought we might encounter. My partner even wrote down some drug doses for both scenarios. So we wrote down some, at the time we were giving atropine to fight web spider bites and obviously adrenaline for anaphylaxis as a starting point. So we wrote down some weights and drug doses.
I understand that when you did get to scene, you didn't have your normal workflow of being able to walk to the patient, and instead, very quickly, the patient was in the back of your ambulance. And I wonder what you found when you assessed them.
He was obviously unwell. He sounded much like a pulmonary edema patient does in a nursing home. He sounded really wet. He was agitated with a slightly decreased GCS. As the driver, I would normally be the logistics person, but we kind of hadn't had our time to get out of the car, pick up our packs and walk in as an organized unit. We had really limited access to the child. As the driver, I wouldn't normally be the clinical lead, but as the intensive care person, we really needed to do a role reversal at that point in time. So from a treatment point of view, you know, we worked through our normal treatment. I really wanted to get some control of the situation. I felt analgesia was important. We worked towards cannulation, got a cannula in, that got pulled out. And something I reflect on now when I think about that job and what I can feel, and it's a feeling, not a memory, is that the child was the same age, same size, same sex as one of my children. And then interestingly, it became evident, had the same name as that child of mine. So I can still hear the dad saying that name and saying that name in a really distressed way. And I find that from a human factors point of view, I didn't recognize it at the time, and I say it out loud, it's quite obvious. It was actually something really difficult for me to process. But we moved forwards and we did a bunch of good things. We redirected the hospital destination. They were going to a local hospital. We changed the plan there and redirected to a bigger hospital, made contact with the major hospital and asked if they had, just to confirm they had antivenom and just to confirm whether they would prefer us to go to the kids' hospital. But given his clinical condition, they would prefer us to come to them, which we did. And they actually, on arrival at hospital, they teleconferenced with the kids' hospital, which was quite an amazing thing to see. In my reflection in the moment for me, I felt a sense of lack of control. I felt that I was doing a lot of things, but none of them were productive. None of them were working towards the goals that I felt that I had in my head. I wanted to get some access to give some analgesia. I wanted to get some oxygen on, but to do that, I had to manage his agitation. To this day, when I think of this job, I feel like I should have been better at that point in my career at handling. But I also now can look back and see that a lot of these details, one, were beyond my control, and two, probably didn't affect the overall patient outcome and management. I guess I look at this now, having come out to error medical retrieval and sat through some Cliff Reid human factors, soft skills, speed talks, and now recognizing that the child's name was relevant. The fact that we didn't have our normal preparation on entrance to the job was really relevant. And I think about the things that if I had that, with the knowledge I have now from a human factors point of view, what could I or would I have done differently? And I think some of the lessons for me is up until that point in my career, I had allowed the environment to control me somewhat. It was a matter of, if we're in someone's house, this is how I behave. If it's an MBA, this is how I behave. But what I could have done and what I'd like to think that I do now is I control the environment. Yes, I didn't have the chance to knock on the front door and say, hi, my name's Jackie. But I could have at any point paused that situation and said, okay, guys, I need a pause. We need to stop so we can recap. I'm going to start from scratch. My name is Jackie and this is what we're going to do for you. That for me would have changed everything in the way this job played out. So I guess, how do I use this to change my practice? I find myself using this now significantly more to help others in debrief with other staff, because I think it's given me really good insight. When we attend big jobs as a medical team, it's easy to forget that whilst big traumatic events are business as usual for us, they're not for the road crews that we're supporting. And we, you know, we have a workforce with a really varied level of experience. And I can see now, I can see myself and some of these people, and I can see that for them, the particular job that we've just assisted them with is potentially their version of my funnel web spider job. you know, they've done nothing wrong. They've actually done a really good job. And I say to them in debrief, oh, you've done this well and that well. But they feel within themselves that they know the chaos that was in their mind. And I think that's the hardest thing for me is I look back and I know the chaos that was in my mind. And whether people say, oh, you did this well or you did this right, it doesn't matter to me because I know it was chaotic in my mind. And that feeling won't go away. I don't think I'll change the way I feel about that job. I'm more circumspect about it. But you'll never take away the feeling of unsettledness that I have about that job. And I think that's something that I try really hard to share with others is that I understand that. I understand that that last 45 minutes that I've helped you and we might have done an RSI, but you feel stressed about your part in the job and trying to help them see that this is normal.
I'd like to touch on that because there appears to be an absolute difference between how you felt at the time and how you feel about that job now and how the job played out and the care that was delivered to this child. Because by the sound of it, you were on scene for, you know, just over 10 minutes and you got them to an appropriate center and you took the caregiver with you. And I am willing to place money on the fact that the chaos that you felt in your mind and that you feel now is not what was experienced by observers to that job. And I wonder, therefore, how, if we can reflect on the disconnect between that kind of that internal monologue and the external appearance, because, you know, one of the other CCPs at Sydney Hems, who's been doing the job for, you know, almost 40 years, famously says that they've never done a perfect job, and that feeling of having something to improve upon and that feeling of internal self-reflection and kind of criticism is always there. And by the sound of it, you've been able to pivot that into an education role where you're able to help others. But that's still quite challenging for you personally to deal with. And I wonder how you've been able to build up that resilience to, you know, still proceed and deliver excellent care at the next job and the next and the next and the next?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. And I think some of the skills I've learned and am learning have been from working, like you say, here at Retrieval with incredibly experienced people who share the same stories. When you come to an area where everyone previously I've seen as being amazing and untouchable, and then they share a story with me about a moment they felt inadequate or a moment that they failed. When those short stories get shared, I think we all get to feel that this is normal and this is okay, and you have to be a little bit kind to yourself. So when you're leading those jobs, and now I am in a position where I get to be a leader at these jobs, you know, relatively routinely, I think that the answer is somewhat in the, like you say, the outsider whilst you're performing the role, not seeing the chaos. You might know it's there. You need a level of control of it, but you know it's there and they don't see it. So you have to be able to, you know, it's the duck on the water type situation during the job. But I think that phase two for everybody benefiting to that is the admission after the job about the things that were concerning you. If we do a debrief and I stand there as one of the senior paramedics and I say, this was great, everything was great, we did all this great and I felt wonderful, then nobody benefits. Nobody feels that it's okay to admit to their mistakes. Nobody feels that it's okay to discuss the inadequacy that presumably we all feel. There might be a few Teflon people out there that don't feel it, but we all feel it. So you need that balance of you can't be discussing your feelings in the height of the moment, but you need to be able to express them and explain them to staff to give them permission to improve as well, because they won't improve unless they reflect. So I think you need both.
And I wonder if at all in the moment to rationalize that chaos feeling that you're describing could be that of a pause point or a 30-second check back. And I wonder if that's something that you teach the paramedics that you now mentor, and if it's something that you could discuss with us now as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's amazing. If you could say there's one thing I've learned in the 4 or 5 years I've been here, it's the value of buying yourself time. And that time comes with various phrases and various language, I think. I think that's where the skill is. So for you and for me, it'll be a different language. But for me, it'll be, hey, guys, let's just take a minute. Can we all stop for a sec? just confirming that I have the handover correct and we're all on the same page. You know, my language generally sounds like, you guys turned up and you found A, B, and C. Is that correct? And you've done that? Okay. And since then, as a team, we've done this. And ultimately, the plan will be to do X. And if I explain that to everybody and give them plenty of buy-in at the end of it, to have an opinion, to change perhaps the perspective I have on the job, I think that's important for patient care, but it's also important for making everybody stop. I don't think we have to call stop to the job. I don't think we have to call stop and say, this is a pause point, which I think I'm also open to, but I think we can create our own pause points in the way we react and interact with each other. And I think that is so much about language. I know when I started in ambulance 20 years ago, I was always taught that the pause point, this is now how I see it, is taking a blood pressure. I was always told when I was new that if you didn't know what to do, doesn't matter what was wrong with the patient, sit down and take their blood pressure. Because whilst you're doing that, you can think and you can gather your thoughts. And the patient thinks you're doing something productive, which you may or may not be doing. So that was the very, very beginnings of a pause point, which I didn't realise at the time. And now I think that the skill in doing it well is in language and getting everybody on the same page to do that with you, because you can control the pace with your language.
Yeah, nice. And it just helps to share that mental model, and it helps to invite differences of opinion as to, you know, where we're tracking. And you could even add into a pause point like a timestamp, couldn't you? You know, so all right, everyone. So in the next 10 minutes, I'd like us to do X, Y, Z and go to point A, B or C.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's actually probably very important in our setting, is everything does have a time frame around it, because, you know, historically we do things either fast or slow. And that's probably not the way to look at it. The look at it is to prioritize and then work out how time fits around that.
Well, look, Jackie, we've talked about that job and how it made you feel and that feeling of inadequacy. I guess a final point to make is that, just to reaffirm that feeling of inadequacy, everyone at some point, regardless of where they're going to be in their clinical career, is going to feel that way. And I guess one thing that we can all do is be cognizant of that fact and just supportive to that fact that may exist in another team member, and maybe kind of in a debrief afterwards, try and pivot that thinking from one of inadequacy to maybe more one of empowerment. Look, Jackie, we're coming to the end now, but I just want to touch on the fact that this patient was of similar build, age, and had a similar name to one of your children. And we come across this more often than we may think, that a particular case really hits home. And it can be in, you know, maybe fairly obvious ways, like this case of yours, but it can be in less obvious ways that we don't expect as well. And I wonder if you've had a chance to reflect on strategies to, you know, almost park that aspect of a job at the time, so it doesn't become an unhelpful hindrance.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Sam. I, in this particular instance, have struggled with it because I feel it was so stark and so in my face. What I do think I've learnt to do and got better at is strategizing and prioritizing my response to jobs. So understanding and I guess allowing myself, I think perhaps what I should have done in that instance is given myself a minute just to accept that this is unusual and that this is stressful. And I think once you allow yourself to admit that the situation is not business as usual, you can then say, okay, accepting it's not business as usual, here is my plan, here's my strategies, here's the jobs, the roles, the tasks we need to do. And once you become task focused and you're clear in that leadership style, I think you're less affected by the personal details or the personal effect. I don't think in this instance I did a good job of accepting it and moving on. I kind of, my thoughts just spiraled and spun around that situation. So I'd think of something clinical and then I'd return to the oddness of the situation. Then I'd think of something clinical and I'd return. I think the skills I've developed since then allow me to accept it, to think about it for a second, and then move on to something else and park it. And it's going to come back up. Like, I'm going to deal with it in the debrief or a month later, or it still pops into my mind every now and then when my child's name said at home. And this is many years ago. Sometimes in the way his name is said, it will remind me of that dad. And I don't think I'll ever shake that. And it's not causing me great grief. It's just something that's there. So I guess my thought is, because you're right, we do many jobs that have the potential to make you feel this way. And I think possibly that the best answer is to accept them, to acknowledge that it's an issue, and then move forwards. I think maybe it's the acknowledgement. I hope you can edit all this.
Yeah, for sure. Well, look, we're coming to the end now. And as ever, I'd like to thank you very much indeed for sharing your experience and sharing your learning. No doubt you're going to be a fantastic educator for the pre-care trial and maybe even beyond that as well. So thank you very much for taking the time out of your Saturday morning to record this with us.
No problems at all, Sam. I'm glad I finally got here.
We sure are as well. And until the next time, we certainly invite any feedback. Samuel Bulford is my name. And until the next time, have a wonderful day and a wonderful week, and we'll speak to you soon.